From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Neil Thompson is my guest, and he has just published a biography of Robert Ripley, the cartoonist who created an empire based on a comic strip called Believe It or Not. A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley is the name of the book. Neil Thompson, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks, Gary. Good to be here.
I just returned from a trip to Europe, and I was in Denmark and London, and in both places I saw gigantic Ripley's museums there.
He's still with us. His influence is all around us. In fact, I make that argument in the book that for a guy who's been dead since 1949, evidence is Ripley being all around us is still pretty solid.
Yeah, and there were, you know, crowds in that museum.
Yeah, I think people still want to see the kinds of weird things that Ripley presented during his day. I think whatever he tapped into early on in his career, it's the same kind of curiosity that people have today.
Well, I guess people do have long memories. Now, in your book, you mentioned that Ripley was profiled in the New Yorker many years ago, and you say that the profile suffered from inaccuracies or some remotely negative thing. And I guess the New Yorker magazine has a long memory, too, because your book inspired like a long piece about Ripley. The information was taken directly from your book, but A Curious Man. But they take special care to put your book down.
Well, speaking of curious, it was a very curious story I found. And in fact, I went through my book to revisit what I said about the New Yorker article and never mentioned that there were inaccuracies in the piece. I'm not sure quite where they got that. Yeah, it was a strange look at Ripley's life, which, as you said, a lot of it described things that I relate in my book, but for some reason they didn't find merit in my book and only found merit in the 1940 New Yorker story.
They were rising to the defense of their of the New Yorker profile that was just published a mere 70 years ago.
Right.
I did think it was odd, but of course it's good because people then are now, if they're interested in Ripley, they're going to find your book.
Well, I've told people I can't complain about having my guy Ripley featured in five pages in the New Yorker. I actually just wonder if they even read my book.
Well, they must have because everything they said was directly from your book. So. And I read your book, and I enjoyed it so much. And I enjoyed getting to know this guy, Ripley. What a strange and brilliant character he was. And a curious man. He had these bizarre teeth that stuck out every which way.
Yeah, I found there was just so much about him to like, for me anyway. I mean, he sort of tapped into a lot of the things that I like to research and write about. I describe him as kind of the ultimate underdog, part of which has to do with this his strange looks. As you said, he had these terrible buck teeth that he was born with. There's some photos in the book from his childhood, and he's really just a strange-looking kid, an unfortunate-looking kid. And I think because he had those strange looks and those awkward buck teeth, and he also stuttered, he was really picked on as a child and was treated as something of a misfit. Spent a lot of time alone, spent a lot of time just drawing, and it was that sense of being an outsider that I think kind of stuck with him, and later in life allowed him to appreciate what it was like to be an outsider. And ultimately, his whole career ends up championing underdogs and outsiders and weirdos and misfits. So I think there's a direct connection between who he was as an awkward little boy and who he was as this fabulously famous and wealthy media pioneer who celebrated the oddness of the world.
I was inspired, with I'm sure many of your readers will be, to go and look for more, and I found this lovely disc from the Warner Archive of all the Ripley's Believe It or Not shorts that he made in the 1930s. And they're wonderful. They're hysterical. But, I mean, he actually draws on camera for you. Not enough. They don't show him drawing enough.
Yeah, some of those old films are just great. I think I found that same disc and got some other radio programs from the 1930s. And it's just great to see him in the flesh and to see what an awkward guy he still was as a performer. I mean, he certainly wasn't a slick, comfortable stage presence like others were at that time, you know, Bing Crosby or Jack Benny or other well-known radio and stage performers. You know, it came with difficulty to Ripley. But again, it's that underdog quality that I appreciated in him. Even though he wasn't a natural performer, you know, he gave it his best shot, and I think people responded to that, responded to him just being who he was, being himself. But yeah, some of the old footage is really great.
And he was also a natural artist. I would you say he was an artist first and foremost, that was the main thing that he did?
You know, that's actually a really good point because, you know, as I've talked about the book to other places, we'd spend a lot of time talking about his influence today, his TV show, and other things. But you're right. I think at his core, he was an artist, and he took it very seriously throughout his whole career. He was good at it. I found it interesting to dig up tidbits like the first newspaper job he got, which was in San Francisco, and losing that job because he felt like he wasn't a good enough artist, and that inspired him to take drawing classes in the mornings, and then he would go to work after that and then work until 10 o'clock at night, and he just sort of, like everything else in his life, he sort of willed himself to become better and to become the artist he always wanted to be.
At the beginning of Believe It or Not, that wasn't the only thing he did. He did a lot of other kinds of cartooning as well as doing Believe It or Not.
That's correct, yeah. Yeah. So he started out as a sports cartoonist, which entailed drawing either cartoony cartoons about sports, you know, meaning caricatures and funny pictures, or in a lot of cases, serious cartoons about the previous night's sporting event. You know, a portrait of a boxer or a baseball player, or, you know, an action shot of the previous night's game or boxing match or whatever it was. And I found it interesting to learn more about what it meant to be a cartoonist at that time. Cartoons played a pretty important role in the newspaper before photography was commonplace. But these cartoonists had to work fast, you know, go to the game, figure out what they were going to draw it quickly. In Ripley's case, he was also a writer, so he would write a side story that would go with many of his photographs, almost like an illustrated essay package. But he would have to turn it around on deadline, and it would appear in the next day's paper.
Was he good at capturing a likeness of an athlete?
He was, yeah. And I think, as you pointed out, it was something that sort of overlooked about who he was and what he was good at. I think he was a very good portrait artist, very good at capturing action, and he took it very seriously. He wanted to get everything just right, the details just right. I found this in my research. I found this unpublished memoir that he wrote called How to Draw, and it goes into great detail about facial features and proportions, you know, the proportion of the nose to the chin and the ears to the eyes. And so he really gave it a lot of thought and took it very seriously. He wasn't just scribbling, you know, goofy little cartoons.
We're talking with Neil Thompson, and his book is a biography of Robert Ripley. It's called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. I liked, you know, because this people from my era remembered Jack Palance doing Believe It or Not.
Yep.
And he was a pioneer in television also.
Yeah, I found it fascinating that he was sort of a pioneer in whatever media came next during his time. After starting out as a sports cartoonist, he became an author, best-selling author, in fact. His first book, published in 1929, was an enormous bestseller. Then he evolved into early radio, And was a pioneer in that regard, and was always pushing the limits too with his radio shows. He was always trying to find interesting ways to broadcast, or broadcast from strange places. You know, he was always trying to do something that was a little extreme and notable, and if possible, odd. So he broadcast from the bottom of the Grand Canyon. He broadcast from inside Carlsbad Caverns, once from underwater, from foreign ports of call when he was traveling. So he was always pushing himself into new media, and then, as you said, he was a very early pioneer of television. And they're really fun to watch. You can probably find a snippet or two online. Again, he's not the smoothest performer, but people loved it. You know, to see him actually drawing on stage, to see him introduce some of the strange people he had been drawing in his cartoons for years, to see them actually in the flesh on their tiny little black and white screen. Didn't last very long, as you know. He died during the filming of his 13th episode, but at least up until that point, he was very much the TV pioneer.
And you say, were you able to find complete episodes of his television show? Do they still exist?
Yeah, I was able to find a few of them. Unfortunately, not the one where he suffered some type of heart attack or episode and almost passed out on stage. But I found a handful of the others. I think I have, six or seven maybe. Hmm. I'm not sure if they're all available online somewhere. I did a lot of my research at this company called Ripley Entertainment, which allowed me to access their archives, and they have a lot of old Ripley footage, both the TV shows and a lot of his travel films as well, and home movies.
Did the Ripley then Corporation, or whatever they are, Did they restrict anything you wrote in your book? Did they have some kind of a final edit or anything like that?
Nope, not at all. No editorial control. I shared the manuscript with them at the very end, just to make sure everything was accurate. I wanted them to know what was coming and know what I was going to say about Ripley. But they didn't blink. I think they were pleased with how it turned out. There might have been a couple of things that they said, actually, this occurred, you know, 1 year earlier or later than you said. No, everything else was wide open. They were great to work with, actually.
I want to ask you about Charles Lindbergh. In 1927, when Lindbergh was the first to fly solo across the Atlantic and became a huge hero, that opened the door for Robert Ripley, and believe it or not, to become a national sensation. What was the connection there?
Yeah, that was one of many, I guess, turning points for Ripley. Up until that point, 1927, he'd been drawing more and more of his, believe it or not, cartoons, but he wasn't doing that exclusively yet. He was still doing sports cartoons and travel essays and travel drawings. And the Believe It or Not cartoons, featuring just hard-to-believe facts and people, they were sort of intermittent. In 1927, Ripley created this cartoon that stated sort of boldly that Charles Lindbergh, now a national hero, was not the first man to cross the Atlantic, but actually the 67th man.
And what? That is outrageous.
Outrageous. That's exactly how people responded. You know, sent him letters and called him names and shook their fist at him and called him liar, which is exactly the kind of acclaim Ripley sought out and wanted. So a couple days later, he was able to verify his claim by stating that two people, Alcock and Brown, a couple of British pilots flew across the Atlantic in 1919. There were two dirigibles that flew across the Atlantic, carrying 30-some people each. And therefore, Lindbergh was the 67th man to cross the Atlantic. What Ripley didn't say in his original statement was fly across the Atlantic solo.
The solo part, that was the trick.
and so he made these occasionally outrageous claims. He called them zingers. And then was able to back them up, you know, in some cases on a technicality like that, or in other cases, he went out of his way to actually debunk something that people accepted as truth, but was actually not.
So there were two kinds of believe it or nots, I guess. There are the ones that were kind of tricks, like that Lindbergh one, and then there were just kind of human oddities that he would find.
Yeah, yeah. And I think I'd say there were more than two, but it breaks down to something like that. Either human oddities or strange aspects of a culture people doing interesting things. I mean,
it's kind of the forerunner of it's kind of the forerunner of the Guinness Book of World Records too, right? There was that aspect of it.
Very much so. Yeah. And I think, you know, people had been doing strange things like that for quite some time, probably throughout history. But what's interesting about Ripley and his Believe It or Not brand is that he finally gives those people a global stage, through his radio shows and his syndicated cartoons and then later TV. People are finally able to share whatever weird feat it is that they did or some weird talent that they have, share it with the world. In much the same way that you can share your stuff on YouTube today and hope that people will find you. Or, you know, any number of reality TV shows that are out there today. But during Ripley's time, he was really the first to broadly portray the things that people did as a hobby or for attention, for whatever their reasons were. And I think the audience responded to that. They wanted to see that. It was just goofy entertainment.
Would people engage in goofy things just so that Ripley would notice them and they could get on the show? Like, I'm going to hold my hand up for 10 years or something?
I think there were a lot of cases where people did it just to get Ripley's attention. There were some competitors at the time who were doing sort of strange but true, either radio shows or cartoons, but they were real small potatoes compared to the real deal, which was Believe It or Not. There were plenty of people who specifically sought out Ripley's attention. In fact, I describe in the book how much mail he received from people wanting to share their strange story with him. Millions of letters per year. There was one fun little anecdote where not only did people send letters about their strange aunt or uncle or their strange ability, but they sent letters that were strange too, just to see if they could actually reach Ripley. So people would send letters addressed in Braille, or in semaphore, or in Greek, just to test the postal service and see if it would eventually reach Ripley. And in 1930, the postmaster general finally put an end to it. He said, I've had enough of these freak letters. From now on, anything addressed to Ripley, or improperly addressed to Ripley needs to go to the dead letter office.
Didn't Ripley himself drop some of his letters off a plane in Africa or something to see if they would come back to him?
Yeah, there's a fun story that I got where did I get that? From a archive at the University of North Carolina. A story about how, he collected so much mail for a while, he didn't know what to do with it all, so he just let it pile up. Then he started throwing everything out until somebody suggested you should write back occasionally just to let fans know you care. So he would, when he'd go on one of his trips, he'd grab a stack of letters and try responding to a few of them. And he was flying over someplace in Africa, I can't recall where, he threw this stack of letters out. I think it was bound in a rubber band, threw it out the window because he didn't want to deal with it anymore. And when he got back home, that same stack of letters had been delivered right back to him.
We're talking with Neil Thompson. His book is called The Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. Kind of sad to me, this story of Ripley's assistant who sat nameless in this little in the New York Public Library looking up all this stuff, and Ripley never really acknowledged him. Is that right?
That's true, yeah. And, unfortunately, they're both deceased, so I was never really able to figure out what their exact arrangement was. This is a guy named Norbert Perlroth, who Ripley met in 1923 when he was looking for someone to provide some translation services for him. They hit it off, and Perl Roth started assisting Ripley initially part-time and then eventually quit his banking job and came to work for Ripley full-time. And he really became sort of this crucial behind-the-scenes partner for Ripley, where he was the guy who was doing a lot of the research, digging up some odd facts for Ripley to use in his cartoons, verifying other odd facts so that Ripley could state them with confidence in his cartoons. But he was never publicly credited as being the behind the scenes guy. And I never came across any evidence of Ripley publicly mentioning Perl Roth's name. He mentions him in private letters, and in his will, he gives Perl Roth some money. But I think it's possible that Perl Roth maybe was happy to be the sort of the silent behind the scenes guy. He loved his job. He actually worked for the company, well beyond Ripley's death, into his 80s. I think he just loved, I have a quote from him somewhere in the book where he says he just loves playing a role in sharing these fairy tales for adults.
Did the Believe It or Not strip continue on after Ripley?
It did, and I think it's kind of interesting that the whole brand continued on without Ripley. At the time of his death, there was no certainty that it would. The company passed through various hands over the next 20 to 30 years, but the cartoon strip continued. Some of his assistants took over the drawing duties. The radio or the TV show lasted another couple of episodes, but then that went away. But then I think it was like in the 80s, there was sort of this revival. Another company, the one that now owns everything, took over and kind of revitalized the whole Believe It or Not brand, which is what led to the TV shows. But the cartoon itself has been drawn continuously since his death. It's one of the longest running cartoons in history.
Still running.
Still running today.
Hmm. Yeah. Is it any good now, or?
It's interesting. Yeah, it's fun. It's still syndicated. You can probably find it online. Or if you visit this Ripley company, Ripley's.com, I know you could access the recent cartoons. It's drawn by a guy named John Graziano. I forget what number he is, but he's the fifth or sixth or maybe even seventh person to draw the Believe It or Not cartoon.
Does Ripley still get a byline on that strip?
That is a good question. I can't remember if his name is on there somewhere.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
I'll have to
look
check it
up. Now, despite his bizarre appearance, he was quite a ladies' man.
Amazingly so, impressively so. he was terrified of women when he was younger. I quote one of his teachers saying that he would run away whenever the girls came near. But later in life, he discovered sort of a knack for wooing women, and he had many girlfriends in his life, which is incredible. And he got more handsome as he got older. I mean, he still had the buck teeth, but he was a very athletic guy, or at least until a little bit later in his life when he became a little bit chubby. But he was athletic. He was outgoing. He liked to have a good time. He liked to eat good food and drink. You know, have drinks and go to parties and dance. And I think people like to be around him, including women. So I go into some detail in the book of how many women he had around him during the peak of his fame, which was a lot. Friends referred to this harem that he had at his. He lived in this mansion north of New York. Moved there in the mid-1930s at a point where he was making $500,000 a year from his various ventures, you know, best-selling books and his radio and his newspaper cartoons and lectures and eventually museums as well. So he lived very well and was able to surround himself with many exotic and beautiful things, including exotic and beautiful women. And he preferred women from primarily China, but other Asian countries as well. I think he liked everything about the East, about Asia, including the women.
There's a whole another book you can write about that. But more than anything, he loved to travel.
He did. I mean, that was truly his passion, and it's interesting that he sort of found a way to merge his passions. One of which is drawing, one of which is curiosity, and one of which is traveling. And so he managed to explore his curiosity about the world by traveling the world, and then sharing that passion with his followers in his cartoons and on radio and other outlets. But he was obsessive about his travels. He was determined. I don't think he quite got there, but he was determined to visit every country on the planet. At one point, he listed over 200 countries that he had visited. But if you nitpick through the list, you can discover that a few weren't exactly countries; they were more like territories or regions. But I argue he was one of the most widely traveled men of his day. He was constantly on the road, and traveling to really remote places at times too, and often veering off the beaten path and trying to elude his tour guides and find a unique experience everywhere he went.
So he's a curious man, not only because he's odd, but because he was curious.
Yeah. So, I think that kind of sums up his life pretty much. Curious in every regard.
It's a fabulous book. I really enjoyed it. It's called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley, and the author, my guest, Neil Thompson. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thanks. I really enjoyed that. That was great.
Well, believe it or not, that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com, and you can find us on Facebook. Subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Neil Thompson. His fine book, A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.